And this is KMXT Kodiak, 100.1 FM. KMXT is also in HD, and we have HD2 and HD3, and we're streaming live on the web at kmxt.org. It's currently 42 degrees out at the airport, overcast, east winds of 5 miles per hour. Tonight, showers likely, with a low around 37 degrees, east winds of around 5 miles per hour, becoming calm after midnight. More rain in the forecast for Saturday with a high near 45. And it looks like we'll have some snow moving in by Saturday night with a low near 36. Sunday's also looking rainy and snowy so far with a high near 48 degrees. Coming up, NOAA is looking for public comment on its proposal to list the sunflower sea star as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. That's after NPR headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Title 42, the pandemic-era public health restriction U.S. officials utilized to slow migration at the southern border, expires next week. Today, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas spent time at a migrant processing site in Arizona where agents are expecting to see the number of migrant crossings increase significantly. He accuses human smugglers of using lies to lure migrants to make the dangerous journey to the U.S.
The border is not open. It has not been open, and it will not be open subsequent to May 11th.
Officials are expecting tens of thousands of people to attempt to enter the U.S. A bipartisan group of senators is proposing a bill that would replace Title 42 to buy the Biden administration more time to roll out a plan. President Biden's top cyber advisor says the White House is still debating how to curb ransomware payments. NPR's Jen McLaughlin reports one major question is whether banning payments in most cases would do more harm than good.
The Ransomware Task Force is a group of government, industry, and academic experts focused on a very costly and worldwide problem: stopping cyber criminals from extorting victims. The group is reconvening after forming 2 years ago. Speaking at the event, Deputy National Security Advisor Ann Neuberger said the White House has accomplished a lot, including seizing stolen Bitcoin. However, she said there are remaining questions, including how to measure success long term. Neuberger also said the U.S. government is still debating whether or not to ban ransomware payments while giving waivers in emergencies. It could make ransomware less profitable, but also put undue pressure on victims who need to quickly restore their networks. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
The U.S. Supreme Court is blocking Oklahoma from executing death row inmate Richard Glossop in less than 2 weeks. Anna France of member station KGOU has an update.
Richard Glossop filed an application for a stay of execution after the Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board split vote at his clemency hearing last month, which resulted in no recommendation for clemency. Glossop was given the death penalty after being convicted of the 1997 murder for hire of his boss, Barry Van Treese. But recent investigations have found evidence that calls Glossop's guilt into question. Glossop has received support from Oklahoma lawmakers and officials, including Attorney General Gentner Drummond. The Supreme Court's order stays the execution pending existing petitions from Glossop. For NPR News, I'm Hannah France in Oklahoma City.
More New Yorkers are calling for legal action against a young Marine veteran accused of killing a homeless black man on a New York City subway Monday. So far, no charges have been filed. Your city comptroller, Brad Lander.
New York City is not Gotham. You can't take the law into your own hands and choke someone to death who's having a mental health crisis.
Manhattan prosecutors have vowed a rigorous investigation. This is NPR News. The U.S. economy is coming off another strong month for job creation. The Labor Department reporting today company payrolls expanded by 253,000, reflecting resilience in the labor market despite high inflation and interest rate increase intended to bring down inflation. The unemployment rate edged down to 3.4%, lowest level in 54 years. President Biden, who recently announced his reelection campaign, praised the report. He's in a standoff as well with House Republicans over the debt ceiling. They want to attach an increase in the borrowing limit with deep federal spending cuts. Biden says there should be no strings attached. Tomorrow is King Charles III's coronation. The area around Buckingham Palace is decked out in flags and bunting, as NPR's Lauren Frayer reports from London.
Thousands of fans of the British royal family have camped out along Saturday's parade route. Judith Nix and Carol Barnes came from Leicestershire, braving typical British weather.
We've got ponchos, plastic ponchos, we've got raincoats, we've got umbrellas, we've got plastic bags to put our bags in.
If we get wet, we get wet.
King Charles and Camilla, the Queen consort, will ride past in a horse-drawn carriage to Westminster Abbey, where they'll be anointed with holy water from Jerusalem. A coronation theme song composed by Andrew Lloyd Webber of Cats and Phantom of the Opera fame will debut at the ceremony. And the spectacle will end with a military flyover at Buckingham Palace. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, London.
On Wall Street, major market indices end the day up 1.5% to 2%. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Details at CapitalOne.com. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Kirsten Dobrath. After a lawsuit from Alaskans in need of food aid, the Alaska Department of Health has agreed to cut the waiting list for the state's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program by half in 6 months. The Alaska Beacon reports that the action was among several conditions in an agreement announced Tuesday between the state and 10 plaintiffs who filed a class action lawsuit against the state over extensive delays in what's commonly referred to as the food stamp program. In a prepared statement released by email, Department of Health Commissioner Heidi Hedberg and Attorney General Treg Taylor said the state is doing everything it can to eliminate the waiting list, which stood at more than 10,000 people as of April 20th. The text of the agreement says the state has signed a contract for 75 contract workers to help alleviate the backlog, and that it expects all of them to begin working no later than July 1st. Alaska's backlog began growing last year as the state exited the COVID-19 pandemic emergency and congressionally authorized changes to the SNAP program ended. In other news, a bill that would make Juneteenth a paid state holiday advanced from the Senate to the House on Wednesday. Juneteenth commemorates the day that Black American slaves were granted freedom in Texas on June 19, 1865. Observance of Juneteenth nationwide has surged in recent years. It became a federal holiday in 2021, and 24 other states now observe the holiday. The Anchorage Assembly voted to make the day a paid holiday earlier this year. Bill sponsor Anchorage Democrat Senator L.V. Gray Jackson told the Senate that passing the bill is an important step.
By recognizing Juneteenth as a state holiday, we can celebrate and honor our African American community's contributions and acknowledge the injustices they have faced.
About 35,000 Alaskans identify as Black, according to the most recent census. Gray Jackson's bill passed by a 16-4 vote. Among those opposed was Wasilla Republican David Wilson. Wilson, who is also Black, told the Senate Finance Committee last month that he opposes the bill because of the way the holiday has been commercialized in recent years.
Oh, I'm tired of seeing the Juneteenth malt liquor sales, Juneteenth fried chicken sales, Juneteenth watermelon salad sales. And my culture is not a fad to be worn by people when they choose to wear it and when they choose not to wear it. And having the state of Alaska participate in it is more offensive to me than anything else.
Opponents also criticized the cost of the holiday. The bill is estimated to cost the state an extra $1.3 million, mostly in costs for overtime for law enforcement and prison workers. It's unclear if the bill has enough support to pass the House. In other news, the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Alex Haley returned to Kodiak after a 30-day patrol around the Bering Sea. That's according to a Coast Guard press release dated on Wednesday. The 282-foot cutter sailed over 2,000 miles from Kodiak and the Alaskan Peninsula to Adak and north of the Pribilof Islands. Along the way, the Alex Haley responded to a medevac request and took patient from King Cove to Cold Bay in low visibility. The crew trained and practiced drills throughout their journey. Crew simulated fire response, ran flooding drills, and practiced manual navigation without GPS in case of emergencies. Commander Brian Whistler, the Alex Haley's commanding officer, said after the long journey, the crew was, quote, thrilled to return to their families here in Kodiak, end quote. The Coast Guard has already begun preparations for their next patrol. And earlier this year, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration proposed listing the sunflower sea star as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The proposal comes as disease has wiped out billions of sea stars from California up the western coast to the Aleutians in Alaska. As the agency is now asking for public comment ahead of its decision, KMXT has this report. Sea star wasting syndrome is one nasty bug. When it infects a sunflower sea star, one of the largest kinds of sea stars, it causes blister-like lesions and the creature's legs to fall off, killing the animal within 72 hours. What's left behind is essentially a pile of goo where it disintegrated.
And then the ocean currents carry that goo away, and 10 days or 2 weeks you might have absolutely nothing remaining of the animal.
Sadie Wright is a protected resource biologist with NOAA. She says the mortality rate is 90% in some areas of the sunflower sea star's range, spanning from southern California out to southwestern Alaska, and billions of sea stars have died from the disease in the last decade. NOAA received a petition back in 2021 to protect the animal under the Endangered Species Act. In March, the agency announced it was proposing to list the species as threatened in response, and now it's gathering public comments as part of a review process that will decide whether the sunflower sea star will ultimately be listed as threatened or not. Wright says the agency is hoping to fill in data gaps about the species, particularly in the waters off Alaska's coastline.
We have some data. We have really good data, time series data in a couple of places, but it would be great to get a broader perspective.
Wright was in Kodiak earlier this month for a public hearing about the species as part of NOAA's review. About a dozen people attended. Another dozen called into the meeting. Some fishermen said they noticed a dip in the population a few years ago. Recently, though, more healthy-looking animals have been coming up on their gear. Wright says that fits with other reports NOAA has received from the area so far.
It does sound like Kodiak is having a relatively strong recovery of sunflower sea stars, so that definitely gives us reason, I think, to be hopeful.
Researchers don't know exactly what causes sea star wasting syndrome, but Wright says they don't believe it's related to fishing activities. Take would not be prohibited under the proposed threatened listing. Longliners and fishermen using pot gear most commonly encounter the sea stars. Wright says anyone can submit information or input on the process, and it's all helpful. Photo submissions are even better.
We're asking people going forward if they could provide a measurement from the center of the animal's body out to the tip of its longest arm.
Members of the public can submit comments to NOAA through May 15th. If the agency issues a threatened listing, the soonest it would go into effect would be March of next year. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath. The Army Corps of Engineers is preparing to clean up Fort Larned, a former World War II military outpost in Unalaska Bay. The fort housed anti-aircraft and anti-ship artillery at Eider Point on the western side of the bay. The site was decommissioned after the war. The artillery and munitions were exploded to dispose of them, but according to the Corps, the explosion was not done in a controlled way.
Fragments and sometimes whole pieces of ammunition were kicked out of the explosion.
Ellen McDermott is part of the cleanup team. She says more than 200 munitions have been found in the area around Fort Larned as recently as 2016.
The frequency with which items are found at the site suggests that there are a fair number of projectiles still out there, and we don't know where they are.
The Corps plans to visit the site later this month for a preliminary survey, and the actual cleanup is slated for next year. Alaska's top medical officer says the state came through the pandemic surprisingly well and capitalized on lessons from the last major pandemic a century earlier. Dr. Ann Zink was in Sitka last week for a meeting and presentation on pandemic preparedness in the circumpolar north. She dropped by KCAW to preview some of her remarks, and KCAW's Robert Wolseley has this report.
Dr. Ann Zink is an emergency room physician from Palmer. She became the state's chief medical officer in 2019, just prior to the arrival of COVID-19. She was a constant presence in statewide media throughout the pandemic and a trusted source of information. Zink thought Alaska rode out the pandemic on the determination of its residents. She doesn't want that idea to be overlooked.
At the end of the day, though, I hope that what we will take from this pandemic is a sense of resilience and strength. It was just a phenomenal opportunity and privilege to see communities and communities of strength come together and respond to a huge existential crisis in really powerful ways.
In early 2020, Alaska braced for the inevitable arrival of COVID-19. The precedent had been set almost exactly a century earlier during the last great pandemic.
During the 1918 pandemic, the influenza virus came in primarily via fishing, and it also came in somewhat by mail, but mainly via fishing. And so communities that kept fishermen out and kept mail out continued to have culture and identity and did not see the loss that communities had where it came in, particularly during fishing. And we started to see the same thing here in the pandemic. In fact, our very first case was a cargo pilot. You know, we're the third busiest cargo airport now in the world. Like, we have a lot of people who come in and out. And for fishing, we have a lot of people who come in and out, and there's a lot of movement.
The lesson of 1918 guided the state's response in 2020 and 21, develop partnerships with the industries most reliant on transient workers, and contain the virus to prevent its spread to surrounding communities. Zink says there was extraordinary cooperation among businesses, and unlike 1918, the state recorded no direct transmission of the virus between the fishing industry and its associated communities. She referenced the opinion of U.S. Centers for Disease Control Director Rochelle Walensky that these kinds of success stories were not the most visible during the pandemic.
Dr. Walensky had a quote the other day. She said, your head might be in the fire and your feet might be in the freezer and your average temperature is just fine, but your experience is really different. And I think that was really the experience in Alaska in many ways. And so particularly with fishing, we just really had to stand in. And I am incredibly grateful for the fishing companies and the independent fishermen and all the towns and communities where it was amazing partnership to say, how can we maintain fishing and livelihood and business and economy and food?
Zink says the state's healthcare establishment is learning as much coming out of the pandemic as going in. Her feeling, which she expressed in Zoom meeting after Zoom meeting during the pandemic, is that there are many more threats to the health of Alaskans than viruses.
I'm less concerned about the next pandemic, and I'm more concerned about my next shift. And so what ways can we be braiding in health and wellness into everyday activity? And so that's a lot of my focus now with the state.
Zink says that Alaska is unique among the 50 states in that all 229 sovereign tribal nations have joined with the State Department of Health and Social Services to develop a long-term health improvement plan called Healthy Alaskans 2030. Reporting in Sitka with help from Brooke Schaefer, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Expert witnesses testified in court on Wednesday that traditional tribal values are ingrained in Southeast Native culture. They were testifying in a trial to determine if it is constitutional to display traditional tribal values in Ketchikan schools. Cultural anthropologists and professors took to the stand to answer questions about what the values mean to Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people. KRBD's Reagan Miller was in court and has this report.
A trial has been ongoing in Ketchikan to determine if displaying the 14 traditional tribal values developed by area culture leaders violates the First Amendment. About a third of Ketchikan students are Alaska Native. Stephen Langdon is a professor of cultural anthropology. He testified that the values all hinge around the idea of respect, central in Southeast Native culture.
Well, what's critically important is that people have to learn to live together, and by understanding others, it's much more successful to be able to live together.
The idea of reverence for our Creator is what plaintiffs Justin Brees and Rebecca King say violates the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. They say that hanging the posters in school common areas without context or a lesson is endorsing the values. They also take issue with how the values are used in a behavior reward program at Ketchikan Charter School. Langdon said there isn't a religion or a specific deity worshipped by Tlingit, Haida, or Tsimshian people. He told several traditional stories from clans around the region to emphasize how the values are integral in the native way of life. He referenced stories about the character Raven, which is both creator and trickster. He described the stories as teaching tools.
The ways in which they are used in teaching is to think about what Raven is doing, and it's not necessarily in a positive light.
But Plaintiff Brees pointed out what he believed to be references to creation in Raven stories. Plaintiff Rebecca King spoke at length in court on Tuesday. On the final day, Brees highlighted a website from the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, which makes a reference to the creator that blessed indigenous people with the land. The site also has a passage that includes a description of the story Raven and the Creation Story, and describes it as a story about, quote, how the raven created the world. But Langdon said that he doesn't think the example was typical.
Well, that's an unusual use of the word creation from the vantage point of Western thought.
He said that the term doesn't really translate to English, and raven stories aren't creation stories. They're meant to teach lessons.
Or who Raven is supposed to be a part of.
Rosita Worrell is the president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. She testified that the meaning of the word creator got misinterpreted in translation.
In our culture, reverence for, you know, our creator, you know, doesn't refer to any god or any deity that we worship. That's absolutely not, you know, within our culture. Within our culture, creator could refer to multiple beings.
Worrell said that the Southeast Native culture includes a belief that everything has a spirit, even a rock or a table. She said that the values need to be taught to promote healing from historical wrongs. They are necessary to openly living a traditional way of life.
We want people to learn about our culture and our values.
In closing arguments, Brees said that the district is teaching the spiritual beliefs of indigenous people.
They are used as a guidepost for behaviors and beliefs required of a good student. Recognizing and rewarding students for following the 14 traditional tribal values shows the district is teaching, promoting, and endorsing those tribal values instead of teaching about them.
John Patasson, the attorney for the school district, argued that not every reference to a creator violates the First Amendment. He said that the values are deeply ingrained in an indigenous way of life, which has a place in public schools.
These values take on a meaning which are social and customary for these people, and it has taken on that meaning for the last 12,000 years. Every feature of everyday life, be it subsistence ceremonies and every object that the experts and all the witnesses have shown you, these are the values by which they live.
Wednesday marked the end of the civil trial in Ketchikan Superior Court. Judge Catherine Librand did not give an estimated timeline for her decision, but told the courtroom she didn't expect it to take long. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Cool temperatures during April have delayed breakup and greenup, and that in turn will delay Alaska farmers from getting their crops into the ground. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, that means farmers are facing the likelihood of a below-average harvest for the third year in a row.
Delta Junction farmer Scott Mugridge has to throttle up when he steers his tractor onto a muddy and partially submerged field to scatter some hay for the 50 or so hungry cows and calves there. Mugridge grows hay and feed for his 600 head of cattle, and he sells the rest to livestock owners around the state. But he worries he may not have any surplus this year because cooler than average temperatures last month kept his fields mostly covered with snow until the last week or so. And he says unless it warms up quickly, it'll take a couple of more weeks at least before the meltwater soaks in and the mud dries enough to begin planting hay and barley.
We're a long way from planting this year. You know, the next step's going to be getting enough heat in that soil to sprout any crop to start with.
Phil Kaspari is the Delta Area UAF Cooperative Extension Service agent, and he says the presence of all that snow and slush on fields around the area means farmers aren't going to be able to get those plants in the ground anytime soon.
We normally like to be in the field really making good progress around May 10th, and that isn't going to happen.
Kaspari says grains like barley should be planted by May 25th to enable it to mature enough to ensure a good harvest, and also because that's the cutoff date for farmers to be eligible for a full crop insurance payout if the growing season turns out poorly again.
Last year, with all of the snow that we had, a lot of guys didn't get started until the 22nd, 23rd, and we had that late July frost and then that early August frost.
Muggeridge says farmers were already dealing with problems left over from the pandemic, like a sluggish supply chain and high fuel and fertilizer costs. And he says if cool weather persists, farmers are facing the prospect of a third consecutive year of poor harvest.
When we have these late plantings, we hope we have a extended late fall or something, but we really haven't had those either.
A late spring warm-up doesn't mean the growing season will extend later into the fall, says Rick Toman, a climate specialist with the University of Alaska Fairbanks' Center for Climate Assessment and Policy. But he says this summer's long-term forecast suggests it'll be warmer than usual in the interior and that rainfall will be about average.
The odds tilt to favor significantly above normal.
Toman says he understands why farmers would like temperatures to warm up as quickly as possible, but he says gradual warming is better to reduce the chances of flooding.
With the deep snowpack, with the very cold April, were we to have temperatures, in the 70s, which at this time of year is entirely possible, that would be a real recipe for serious breakup flooding.
Muggeridge is president of the Alaska Farm Bureau, and he says farmers around the state are dealing with the same problem. He says he's encouraged by higher temperatures over the past few days in the interior that have melted most of the snow on his fields, and he's glad to hear about the warmer-than-usual summer forecast.
We can still get there this year. I mean, we may be late, but maybe we'll have the fall that'll make a bountiful crop.
That's a hope shared by all of Alaska's farmers and livestock producers. Meanwhile, Muggeridge says he'll continue to use last year's harvest to keep his cows contented. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The U.S. economy added more jobs than expected in April. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute. A gain of 253,000 jobs, and instead of rising as expected, the unemployment rate fell to 3.4%. The Labor Department did revise downward its estimates of job gains in February and March. Average hourly earnings rose 0.5% in April, the biggest jump in nearly a year. That's unlikely to satisfy the Federal Reserve, which wants to slow the labor market and the economy to reduce inflation. The Treasury Department wants to expand regulations that require federal review of real estate transactions when foreign citizens buy or lease properties near 8 military bases. Areas affected would include Phoenix and a large part of the Los Angeles metro area. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute.
Marketplace Minute is supported by JLL, providing commercial real estate investment and technology. See a brighter way.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Well, good afternoon. It's Friday, May 5th. The year is 2023. Sunrise today was at 6:08 a.m. Sunset tonight will be just after 10 o'clock, 10:05 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:06 a.m. Right now, we are getting 15 hours and 57 minutes of daylight. It's just under 16 hours. Record high for today was 68 degrees back in 2004. Record low was 18 degrees in 1945. Looking at our marine weather from Armid Island to Sikkenak out to 15 nautical miles today, northeast winds of 15 knots with seas to 5 feet. Tonight, variable winds of 10 knots with seas to 4 feet. And Saturday, southwest winds of 20 knots except variable winds of 10 knots north of Dangerous Cape with seas to 3 feet. Looking at the Shelikof, today, northeast winds of 20 knots with seas to 4 feet. Tonight, north winds of 15 knots with seas to 3 feet. Saturday, southwest winds of 20 knots with seas to 4 feet. The time for a few community announcements. The Kodiak City Council will hold a budget work session on Monday, May 8th. The meeting will begin at 4 p.m. The meeting is open to the public, and it will be web-streamed, and the web-streaming link and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak's website. There's also a Kodiak City Council work session on Tuesday, May 9th. That meeting is at 7:30 p.m. and is also open to the public. It will be web streamed. Meeting packets are online. You can also listen at KMXT. If you have any questions regarding either meeting, please contact the clerk's office at 486-8636. And for any birders out there, meet Marissa Trombley from the Alaska Bird Treatment and Learning Center and learn all kinds of things about her amazing feather friend, Breland, the peregrine falcon. That's Saturday, May 13th at Kodiak College in the Benny Benson Building. Starting at 10:30 to 11:45, there'll be a bird feeder building, and then at noon to 12:30, a virtual presentation with Breland available for a Q&A. And one more, have you ever wondered about your family's history? Where are you from? What is your family's story? The Kodiak History Museum, Kodiak Public Library, and St. Herman's Theological Seminary Archives have the event for you. Join them on Thursday, May 18th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. for a genealogy event at the Kodiak Public Library. This free event will teach you how to start your genealogical journey and show you with demonstrations all the resources that are available. For more information, you can call the Kodiak History Museum. Their number is 907-486-5920.
KMXT's Spring Plant Sale is this Saturday, May 6th at 1223 West Kuskoff Street. From 10 a.m. until everything is sold, we'll have perennials like primroses and poppies, marigolds, veggie seedlings, rhubarb, currants, indoor plants, and more. Call or text Marion at 907-539-5009 to find out more, or if you'd like to drop off plants to donate. All proceeds go to KMXT, so we thank you in advance.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.